Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Welcome. My name is Danielle Sands. I'm a fellow at the Forum and I'm going to be chairing this evening's event, in which our three speakers will be helping us to think about objects. So the format of the event is that each speaker will address the topic for about 10 minutes, and then there'll be lots of time for discussion and for questions from you. So let me introduce our speakers. So our first speaker will be Professor Daniel Miller, who is Professor of Anthropology at University College London. Our second speaker is Dr. Carolyn Shapiro, who is Senior Lecturer in Cultural Studies at the University of Falmer. And our final speaker will be Professor Esther Leslie, who is Professor of Political Aesthetics at Birkbeck. So I'll hand you over to our first speaker, Professor Daniel Miller.
Right, well, thank you very much for the invitation. So it's like a 10-minute resume of a lifetime working on material culture. Now, as you can see, I'm incredibly old. So when I first started working on this topic, very different perspectives were kind of in fashion. Particularly that time, it was semiotics. So people were interested in things like representation, the sign, symbolism. And in a way, the problem was that if it was about, you know, how do they things represent us, it was a relatively kind of passive notion of what things did. And that didn't seem altogether satisfactory. The other thing that was kind of around at the time was the influence of Western Marxism. And with Marx, you seem to have something that seemed to me a bit more kind of equal in the sense of humanity creates itself in creating the world, in production, in labour, etc. And that seemed attractive. But there were two issues I had looking at that literature. And one was that the overall emphasis was always on production, on making things, which is fine if you're writing about the time of the Industrial Revolution and post, but we live in a world where, frankly, on a day-to-day basis, most of our relationship to things comes through consumption. And the second problem was it was sort of a bit unremittingly negative in the sense that the terminology that came around objects were things like alienation, fetishism, reification, which didn't sound altogether everything that we wanted to say about how objects kind of related to us. And that was the time when I sort of looked back into philosophy. Now, I'm no philosopher. I'm unremittingly vulgar in the sense I didn't even try and be true to the philosopher. I kind of used the ideas to try and develop my own ideas. But tracking back through Marx to find out the ideas in Hegel that had influenced him, I felt I saw something rather different, something that was to me a bit more complete. It completed the kind of cycle that you could see ways in which, yes, there are periods of something we might call alienation represented by things, but then there's some sense in which they came back to us. Now, to translate that, what I felt was what you could call alienation was in a sense something that was intrinsic to modern society, in that if we were in some kind of William Morris utopia and everybody was like crafty, that would be fine, but there wouldn't be a whole lot of things, right? We'd be very poor, all of us. So actually, to create the stuff that is around us and we use, of necessity have these processes of industrialization, commercialization, etc. So when you come across a thing in a shop, it's a thing in the sense it belongs to a corporation, etc. And you could call that sense of it's alienated. We don't feel any relationship to it. But then comes the process of consumption, in which somebody sees a dress in a shop, right? It's just a dress. But then they get it, and it's mine, and it's accessorized, and it's worn on several different occasions when things happen. And it becomes so personal, you don't even let your sister borrow it. So I see that as a kind of negating the first period, that now it's become something we do associate with in a very different way. So I started to explore the specifics of these processes of consumption. So, for example, in 1995, I did a book called A Theory of Shopping. And rather different from most books about shopping, I looked at shopping as what I called a technology for the creation of love. In the sense that, for me, most of the people I work with in shopping tended to be women. Typical shopping was, say, you buy the ingredients, you make up a meal, you serve it at dinner, and you kind of hope that there will be a family dinner where people appreciate your label, at least notice what it is that they're eating. And that this, in a sense, helps build those strong relationships within family life. So for me, it was this kind of cycle between which made for our personalised relationship with things. And this notion of a cycle, of a balance between the two things, comes also from anthropological sources. I was influenced by people like Pierre Bourdieu. And the point here was, yes, we can talk about what, not only what we make, but also what things do or what we do with things. But also, he recognised that we're born into a world of things. That actually, particularly in many other societies where you didn't necessarily have formal education, the fact that you're born in a particular landscape, an agrarian system, the housing around you, that was what socialises you into being culturally the person you feel you are. So before you even start to do stuff with stuff, actually it's already created you in a quite profound way. So with our material culture studies, it was always this sense of a balance between you have to give equal weight to how things make us as to how we make things. Now, I certainly wasn't the only person interested in creating that kind of balance. And if you look at the sort of blurb for the evening, I suspect the greater influence has come in the last 20 years from the work of Bruno Latour. So you have then this language, which also tries to say, well, we've neglected objects in, again, seeing them as passive, so we have to see them as active, as having agency. It's not just people that have agency, objects have agency, because they do things to us. They fall off a roof and collapse onto us, even if, you know, no human intended for that to happen. And we have to kind of take that into account. He actually would stand against, philosophically, the kind of tradition I've represented, what might be called the dialectical tradition. He said it failed to do that. I think, to be honest, the difference between the two positions, put very broadly, is that Latour comes out of the philosophy of science. He's interested in the relationship between humans and non-humans. So his examples are likely to be things like rocks and bacteria and what they do and the fact that we have to recognise that they have agency. Whereas my work has always concentrated on artifacts, which actually are most of the examples that we have today. And artifacts for me are different because they're not natural things in the world. As mentioned before, they already embody us. Somebody made them into cultural artifacts that we then kind of work with. So I see a different kind of working together when we're dealing with the likes of artifacts. This then developed into the studies of what we call material culture. I come from material culture studies. And we tried then to use these ideas to study closely the relationship between people and a whole range of things. It might be cars, it might be housing, it might be clothing. I spent 5 years looking to try and discover why so many people wear denim blue jeans, for example. And that work developed, but I've just finished by saying, actually, in the last few years, I seem to have sort of veered off, because actually, at the moment, all I work with is online. And people say, well, you know, why, if you're interested in material culture, you're interested in artifacts, why would you now be concentrating on online? Isn't that not material culture? Isn't that virtual or something else? And actually, the reason is I feel I'm fighting the same fight now as I was originally, trying to convince people that objects and consumption had to be taken more seriously, and the materiality of things in creating us had to be taken more seriously. Because actually, I think that online is, again, material culture. It actually has similar kinds of qualities. So we recently, we've just a 9-country comparison of how people use social media. And we look at the specifics of social media. So, for example, we're trying at the moment to develop a theory of memes. We call them the moral police of the internet. We think they're very important in understanding why, how behaviour online is controlled morally. But of course, a meme is specific. It has a particular kind of design, a particular kind of aesthetic. It's shared in a particular kind of way. And you are analysing images online much as you would offline. And the point for online as well as offline, my final point is this. That right from the beginning, the idea was not just to see these from the point of view of making, but to rehabilitate what ordinary people do every day with things and recognise that as itself creative, as that which, if you like, makes the things what they are, the process I've called consumption. And that's why, if you look at the main book that's come out of our project, we don't call it How Social Media Changed the World, we call it How the World Changed Social Media. Because I think the same points, perhaps are even more important to apply to the contemporary world of the digital as it ever was to the previous, prior world of the material. I think that's probably my 10 minutes.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Caroline Shapiro.
Thank you. My own introduction to the theorist quoted in the material that you read, Ian Bogost, his theory, came as a result of my organizing a conference several years ago at Falmouth University entitled Performing Objects. Imagining that I would be coordinating a conference on puppetry, automata, and toy theater, I found that my call for papers yielded proposals for papers and performances coming out of a new philosophical wave, object-oriented ontology, often referred to as OOO. This new philosophical perspective departed radically from the traditional metaphysical philosophy in its shift from the conscious thinking human subject as the central proponent of being to a dispersed, decentralized focus on objects, ever-multiplying objects, ever-interacting with each other through myriad cause and effect. The human subject was no longer recognized as the primary manipulator of objects. Objects moved on their own, operating in units, in motion, highly generative, as a consequence of their active relationality with other objects. Ian Bogost is one of many theorists contending with this paradigmatic shift in philosophy, which has been taking various forms for maybe, I guess, 10 years or so, whereby existence, with a capital E, or being, with a capital B, no longer emanates out of a central human subject, but instead is distributed outwards into myriad objects. This reorientation in being itself holds as its fundamental starting place the prizing apart of being from thinking. This interdependence is a humanist assumption that privileges us, humans, over other operating beings. In these new object-oriented philosophies, and there are different versions, existence takes place in the complex relationality between individual objects. These objects may be anything at all. Peppers, laptops, maple trees, graffiti, manifestos, paintings, novels. There's an infinity implied here. And these objects interact as discrete material unit operations with all other objects. The structure is that of a complex non-hierarchical network, which is always active in operation, both internally within each object, but especially as it relates to other objects. This dynamic model of being is what another OOO philosopher, Timothy Morton, understands as hyper. That is his term for characterizing the constant intra-agency of myriad objects relating and responding to each other. Morton has been embraced by the field of ecological criticism. His most recent book is entitled Hyperobjects, Philosophy and Ecology After the End of the World. That's from 2013. You can see how a philosophical shift away from the centrality of the human subject into the domain of equivalent objects would be embraced as a theory of global ecology. Particularly prominent in this theory is the equalization of human existence with other operating units on Earth. For Morton, we humans have to give up our foundational investment in certainty as the and primary agency. We need, he says, to accept a new general position of perhaps uncomfortable uncanniness, and he calls it uncanniness. I think that the new popular psychology of mindfulness is related to this handing over of thinking to the many objects world. Indeed, Morton and those who follow his work tend to express an exuberance that is very appealing and seems to be a progressive way of thinking. Bless you. OOO is the inevitable philosophical response to new forms of interactive, intersubjective, interobjective human existence based on our inseparability from the internet, an existence which does not obey former pre-internet logics of time and space. Logics which would have been framed through the primacy of human intention. Back to Bogost. Most well known as a theorist of video games, Bogost posits something which he calls unit operations, based on a concept of physics. In a nutshell, everything in a video game, and by extension in the world, operates through a system of cellular automata, that's his term. Mechanized individual entities, each of which performs a single task, but which then also connects to another such entity, and so on, and so on. It's a pretty mechanical and geeky model of existence. But for me, the term automata is key. What is an automaton? Automatons historically have been created by clockmakers. They are machine-like entities which operate as an intact, self-generating, moving system. They often appear to be human, but are not. Rising in popularity in the 18th century, awareness of automata disseminated through public performance events. Human-like machines fascinated that era's philosophers and storytellers, because these mechanical objects seemed to move completely independently from a mysterious, uncanny place, completely outside of human consciousness and intention. Parallel to this fascination with automata at this time in the 18th century was a philosophical and literary inquiry into language and into the human subject's relation to language. Literary theorist Paul de Man read romantic poetry and other literature as a negotiating ground for the recognition and discomfort with language operating as its own machine, separate from what the writer intended, what de Man and other deconstructionists identify as the, quote, machine effect of language. This term comes from Rousseau, who once made an excuse that he could not be responsible for things that he blurted out without thinking. This so-called machine effect is the random or automatic dimension that exists in language completely separate from our intention. It operates, it performs completely outside of consciousness and thinking. In this sense, a speaker can disclaim responsibility for the actions or meanings of words. The machine operation of language leads to a feeling of discomfort, to a lack of control. Paul de Man seems to have gone a bit out of fashion. However, I think that it's time to bring back his investigation into the primacy of language as operational object. The coincidence of the philosophical questioning of language and automata in the 18th century indicates what I would say are the healthy misgivings that we as human beings feel when our words become untethered from their sources. Today, language, like every other object, is indeed a hyper-object. Operating as part of a larger economy of interactivity with other objects, made equivalent through the access to the internet to all information. The object-oriented ontologists deliberately steered away from privileging language and text as the main material of human subjectivity. But I think that probably, unforeseen by them, we reached a breaking point. Isn't Donald Trump's excuse of locker room talk a signal for us to heed? I wonder, in today's post-factual world, Or, to quote Kellyanne Conway, today's world of alternative facts, where language also acts as an object of its own, as a kind of automaton, untethered from its speakers, in viral disregard for referentiality. Whether we need to recognize a particular human responsibility with regard to the particular hyperobjectivity of language. Ultimately, what I would like to propose is the danger of depoliticization once we as humans are only as responsible as a capsicum pepper. The philosophical question today would be, how do we proceed ethically unless we bring back the foregrounding of language as the mandatory site of critical inquiry? Thank you.
Thank you. Our final speaker is Professor Esther Leslie.
Thank you very much. I think this somehow maybe engages some of the same themes as we've heard about. So I want to begin with an act undertaken by the poet and scientist Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. Goethe undertook optical experiments such as screwing up his eyes, twisting his head, staring at the sun and diffracting the light in order to make prismatic patterns play on the inside of his eyelids. He also talked about other types of experiment in which he externalized himself and his making. Writing, for example. If after breathing on a plate of glass, the breath is merely wiped away with the finger, and if we then again immediately breathe on the glass, we see very vivid colours gliding through each other. These, as the moisture evaporates, change their place and at last vanish altogether. If this operation is repeated, the colours are more vivid and beautiful and remain longer than they did the first time. This experiment, written about in or published in 1820 as part of Goethe's theory of colour, evokes the principles of animation, which are repetition, movement, colour, transience, and transformation. In this scene, there is a maker who, in this case, literally breathes the life into the animation made of breath and glass, and who then roughens the surface of the glass with the wipe of a finger, thereby intensifying the colours. But what occurs is also immanent to the materials. Goethe talks about the ways in which the colours slither, vaporise, transpose, and disappear. He also observed this effect inside a carriage on a frosty day, when his own breath was misting the windows. And this made a surface on which appeared, as he says, the most vivid play of colours, the effect being all the more vibrant if the background was dark. The screens onto which Goethe breathed were panes of glass with pirouetting colours and shapes that were fleeting and could not be captured. Such animation is a delicate co-production of self and world, subject and object, whereby the viewer is also the author. Goethe's practice emerged out of a philosophy of attentiveness to the object, an awareness of the subject's relationship to it and the subject's relationality to it. This was the basis of his rejection of Isaac Newton's more objective optics. The object for Goethe is not conceived of as dead or inert, but as a co-producer of an experience, the subject and object enter into a dialogue and neither comes away from the encounter unaltered. For this to occur, the object must have, dialectically, something of the subject about it. And Goethe was not alone in such an approach in the early 19th century. To cite just one other example, the scientist who invented synthetic aniline dyes, Friedrich Friedlieb Runge, developed chromatography, which represented for him, as he put it, the drive to self-formation of chemicals, as chemicals dropped with a dropper onto blotting paper separated out and formed eye-like patterns. I mention these because by returning to a certain romantically infused stance towards nature, we evade the sense in which theory has only recently come to understand the parts that objects play, has only recently overturned the arrogance of the organic, the living, and the appropriation to it of important and determinant agency in this world. I mention it, though, because I also want to charge philosophy itself with ignoring the insights of Goethe or Runge. Philosophy establishes the problem in the first place, to be very crude about this, whereby subject and object stare across an abyss, uncoupled, rivals in a sense to each other, but where one has the meaning and the other is only a resource. I use the word animation in relation to Goethe. Something is given life or displays liveliness under certain conditions. Animation is, in its more restricted sense, as visual entertainment as cartoons. The place where there has long been a focus on objects becoming enlivened or becoming subjects. Chairs that run around a room, or railway tracks that rear up at will, or cars and aeroplanes that swell and smile. Animation has always allowed the lifting of the curtain between subject and object, mixing one into the other, or donating the sensation that, as the German proverb puts it, objects are malicious. That's die Tücke der Objekte. The table edge does bump into you. The skirting board rears up to stub your toe. Animation or cartoons appeared in the recognisable sense, as we would recognise them, towards the end of the 19th century. It's not hard to situate them in relation to another theoretical approach, the relationship of subject and object, which had come into being some 30 years earlier in Marx's writing. Marx's idea specifically of commodity fetishism. Marx's notion of commodity fetishism attributes all sorts of powers of liveliness to the object. For him, it is at one level an illusion, but also simultaneously real. The object is more than you. The object does have power to produce desire, happiness, satisfaction, wealth, and more. Or at least the object as commodity. Our modern viewing selves were shaped in the dots and lines and jerky, saccadic rhythms of cartoons, as well as in their seriality and their inhumaneness. For all the emphasis on animation's quest for liveliness, depth, and development, animation remains a movement mobilized by a machine, its vision of the actor in its world as a mark, a point, a streak, both reduced and overextended. It's this that animation articulates in its animated over-liveliness of everything, or especially of that which is not human. What it articulates then might be the big secret of commodity-producing society, that things, all commodities, dead things, exert more effects on the world than people, living things. Who or what has agency, who or what has productive capacity, creativity and value is hinted at in a mechanism called animation. I mentioned Goethe's glass panes onto which he breathed, and it put me in mind of a contemporary object that would fit the bill as a commodity fetish today. An iPhone, an iPad, any glass surface on which lively events take place. An enlivened surface in the shape of the touchscreen, in relation to which we humans, really become something like an object of the subject that is the glassy surface. We become an object of marketing and surveillance with every click and every touch of the screen, and we become an object or function for it. Contemporary touchscreens, the resistive ones and the capacitive ones and the surface wave ones, have various modes of operation which all involve incorporating the human body to detonate touch events. The resistive screens are satisfied by any hard object pressing down and making contact between two layers in order to change the electrical field, but other screen types deploy the human or other conductors and its electrical charges and participation in electrical fields in order to operate by discharging electricity in the user or mobilizing the human to complete electrical circuits or disrupt the flow of waves. Our electricity is, in a sense, abstracted. force touch sensors measure the pressure of our touch and offer us more menus, more choice, more options among the predefined. For who is the object for whom? Such a relationship to the touchscreen has been described by a few people less as the much-touted interactive experience and more as an interpassivity. To update Slavoj Žižek's examples of this, interpassivity would be letting your MP3 player enjoy the downloaded music for you without you listening to it, or the like on Facebook, or the animated emojis that are so available today and which can do the work of emoting for you. And the soup I opened yesterday, like not a few commodities these days, had written on the package, "How to heat me." It's telling me what I, its cook, should do to it, who is an I. My analysis sounds dour and sort of Marxism that Daniel would like to smash into the ground, but it is as if Goethe might perceive the genuine animation of the object, its self-assertion, its capacities, which may not be its alone, but a product of the relationship between us and it. A product, in Goethe's sense, of a tender empiricism and the ways in which we might make it possible for all of the world, all that exists, to have a voice, to have a life world that we do not crush. So that's one, you know, that's a sort of optimistic version of this recalibration and this mutual exchange of subject and object positions. Marx, influenced by the dialectical thinking of Hegel, would affirm this, but would argue that under the social conditions of capitalism, everything becomes distorted, turned over into its other, and the human becomes tendentially a thing, the thing becomes tendentially enlivened, the more active it is, the more passive I become, the more lively it becomes, the more I become rarefied and thing-like. And such an overturning can only be overturned again by revolution. Well, we may exist in the wake of that and long after those possibilities, perhaps. But the happy embrace of object agency amongst some of the figures that Carolyn has mentioned is a combination of Goethe's insistence on worlds of agency that the attentive might glimpse, together with a rather gleeful and cynical submission to a fetishism and an annihilation of the human that seems all too likely now, accelerating Marx's perception to the maximum, but abstracting from it, or extracting from it, any howl of horror. Thank you.
Thank you. Should we take a couple of questions from the audience? Yep. Lady at the front.
I don't know how this really fits as a question. I'm a social historian, and so what people left behind, the objects, the things, to be recreating their lives from the things that mattered to them or the things that were around them. But listening to this today, this evening, was taken back to early childhood when I knew that stuff. The dolls came alive at night. My toys came alive at night when I was asleep. And I could never catch them. We can never catch them because they know when we're going to wake up and they jump magically back into place. But because I knew they came alive and played at night, they existed not just in relationship with me, but they existed. And they had their own personalities. And that growing up, things sort of do. And that the sort of culmination of, not culmination, but recalling that my parents were married for 72 years and died a year apart, as a lot of older people do. They died in the States. I was living over here. And when I received this impersonal list online from their attorney, the valuation of everything in their home, the bed they'd slept in for 72 years, $5. The Hanukkah menorah around which the family gathered for 5 minutes, those nights once a year, $2. Those, to the person who valued them, were things, objects. To the people who lived around them, to the woman who was standing lighting the candles, it was more than that. And the things that were, that's what made me a historian. Where does this sort of personal, when you're talking about things and ontology or whatever, where does the deeply personal of the things that are lives
Thank you.
fit in?
Thank you. So that's about the kind of value of objects and who determines it. Can we take another question, perhaps?
Yep.
Gentleman in the purple.
My question is more specifically to Professor Shapiro. I don't know if I fully understood the argument you were making, but I think I share a bit of the kind of the uneasiness that you were talking about when reading on object-oriented ontologies and actor network theory, but partially because I don't get what they want morally out of us, like. What am I if I am a human being and we're all human beings and there are human beings writing the text, how am I supposed to take on the object's point of view? But my specific question was, because I got a bit confused, how you start from there and you jumped into language being the only political resource or the best political resource we have, and I would ask you to please elaborate a bit on that, if you could.
Thank you. Okay, so kind of two or three questions. One about the value of objects and who decides it. One about how do I take on the point of view of the object? And the other one about language. So okay. I don't know if you want to take that one first. Or...
Okay. I'm not an expert in object-oriented ontologies, but I've been sort of aware of it for a few years. And I immediately sense a kind of a lack of politics in a way, but although it called itself an ecological movement, where we as humans can no longer afford to be more powerful. You know, so there was this equality between us and animals, between us and the environment, between us and a table. But it also kind of implies that all objects are equivalent, including language. So when language becomes taken away from the speaker, from intention, from who we are, from being human, from the human consciousness, it becomes yet another object that's just like any other object. But what I'm trying to say is that I think language is an exception, and I think right now we're learning that we can't just say a language is an object and it's floating around there just the way everything else is. We have to have an attachment to, you know, where that language comes from, what it means, what it refers to, what the set of historical meanings that it comes out of. And then I'm saying it would go against what the OOO people would kind of be arguing for, because they were trying to get away from language and text as the primary source, which is what maybe things like post-structuralist theory and deconstruction were centered in that. And they really wanted to make a move away from that, to be a little bit more democratic. But what I'm saying is we can't do that anymore, probably. I hope that answers your question.
Any other questions, perhaps?
Yeah. Thank you for your question. I mean, the premise of the discussion today was, are we taking objects seriously enough? Do we really pay attention to the presence they have in our world? And I think you give a really good example of that. I spent a couple of years working with how people deal with bereavement, very much the kind of examples you were just talking about. And I found that every single person understands in themselves, we cannot control when somebody dies, the time of their death, but we can control the way we separate from the things that we associate with the person who has died. So everybody I knew had, in some way or other, their sense of those things that they associated with the lost person. And some they carted off straight away, some they kept forever, and there were all the kind of in-betweens. And this degree to which at least you could control your relationship and make it a gradual process of separation, that actually objects were the main way in which this form of grief and bereavement was actually made possible. And yet, while I was doing that work, I then looked at the whole literature on bereavement. I looked at clinical psychology, I looked at grief studies, I looked at thousands of pages of text. And I am really not exaggerating. I have never seen any of these mention that this has an important role to play in the way people actually separate. So there clearly are still examples where in the world we have your understanding that these do play this really central emotional role in helping us deal with the life around us. And yet, is that present in academia? Sometimes, not at all.
I just wanted to say, I mean, I think it's a fascinating example, but it's also an example for me of that fundamentally. But to me, it doesn't make much sense to talk about just object as object, but I go back to the sort of dual nature of the object as thing of use value and thing of exchange value, and within that use value is all of that affectivity, sentimentalization, the personalization, the way it's taken into our lives, and then there's the bed, £5, you know, so that's sort of part, I think, of how we need to understand objects, that sort of multiple sort of pressures within them.
Perhaps we could go back to the other question, this question of what's demanded of us. So if we're being asked to take on the point of view of the objects, what do we do? What do we do differently? Do we have to do anything differently? And what kind of demand? Is this an ethical demand? Is it something else?
I mean, it can be a demand for... And it could be this sort of ecological demand. I mean, there's no accident that much of the object-oriented philosophy, say through the work of Timothy Morton, has been embraced by ecologists, and, you know, even if it's the sense of a dark ecology, and what I wanted to suggest at the end with this notion of this kind of fatal submission to annihilation of ourselves relates to this notion of if we become less human-centric, then we understand, you know, that time is much longer and we are but a small blip upon this earth and it will go on beyond us. And even if the glaciers melt, in a sense, they become something else. I mean, that's a sort of fatalism. But I suppose what I think's interesting about that and why ecologists have taken it on is just that it proposes a kind of looking and attentiveness, which I've sort of taken through Goethe, to what is nature telling us, or what are these new rocks that are part mineral, part plastic, you know, what is that telling us about the composition within our world, and to what, and it raises, I suppose, the ethical question, which is always a question of the Anthropocene and the Capitalocene, you know, to what extent have human behaviours produced this world, or to what extent, you know, should we just step back and let those processes happen?
I think the question of ethics, it depends on how you're defining ethics. To me, ethics would be responsibility. So responsibility to objects, but really, it sounds like maybe I'm being really old-fashioned, but we are responsible for each other in a human way, and this is why I'm trying to kind of foreground language as being, you know, something we need to take responsibility for instead of letting it go and floating it. There is a kind of ethics that we need to go back to a little bit, because we can't, you know, because we can't really, I mean, it's really going to be hard to proceed in a post-factual world where it doesn't go back to meaning something, and meaning that you're saying something, you mean something, and you have to stand by it. So it depends, maybe if you think about ethics in terms of responsibility to other humans, then maybe that's a very narrow definition. But in
one of the things that triggered me thinking about this topic was having a conversation with someone where I was saying, because I work in animal studies, and the conversation was, is there a difference between if I kick a cat down the road and if I kick a stone down the road? And he was saying, actually, there are ethical implications to both of those things. And I've been really trying to think about what it might mean to have an ethics which is not yoked to sentience in the way that we assume it is.
It's a good question, but Have you figured it out?
No, I really haven't. And it seems like you're still bringing it back to the human. And
I know. It's very old-fashioned, but I just feel like right now maybe we should think about... We should, just because it's gotten to this maximum point now where there is no accountability for what we're saying, I think maybe we need to take a few steps back. It's a little bit retrograde. It's past the object of ontology, but yeah.
And I think, Esther, you kind of bring it back to the ecological. Is there any way we can think about objects ethically in a way that is not kind of... that doesn't always bring us back to the living?
Mm. Well, I suppose that's why I'm interested, say, in this romantic scientist who thinks about the drive to self-formation of chemicals, that one's watching some sort of agency, and it's an agency that we might then harness as scientists in order to make things, although interestingly for Runge it's an aesthetic experience, so it's an experience of something that incidentally happens to be beautiful for us. And similarly, you know, fascinated by the first photography of snowflakes, which is both a sort of act of trying to understand, but also just the production and the magnification of this beautiful part, which only becomes known to us through new technologies of visioning and enlargement. So I'm not sure that... Maybe there's aesthetic relations rather than ethical ones, in a sense, that these worlds... And the aesthetic is part of experience and sensation in its sort of more expanded sense.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that... I mean, Graham Harman, for example, picks up on the aesthetic and says that the aesthetic is first philosophy, and his way into thinking about objects is this idea of allure, that the object as this irreducible thing has some kind of... I don't know, make some kind of demand on us through aesthetics, I suppose. Shall we take some more questions? Yeah, gentlemen, towards the back.
First of all, thank you for some very interesting presentations and an interesting discussion. I would like to, my name is Thomas, by the way, I would like to ask a question about taking on the point of view of the object. And it seems to me that this repeats a failed metaphysics, a Cartesian metaphysics, a dualist metaphysics on behalf of the object. And I don't quite understand it. Why don't we try to, just as we've decentered from the human subject, try once again to decenter from the object? So, for instance, Heidegger, he talks about a hammer in a very famous example in Being and Time, and he says, the hammer itself has no value as an object. It's not till you add the nail and the wood and the project of building through time, of building a building or a piece of furniture through time, that the object becomes what it is, the hammer. If you put the hammer next to a block of ice, it becomes an ice pick. If you're falling down the roof and you use it as a lifesaver, it becomes something else. So it seems to me that the object doesn't become what it is except through being contextualized by other objects. And this would be a way of getting around this repeated failed Cartesian metaphysics, but it means thinking about how the object appears in processes and through time and how it's oriented towards the future. How do you respond to that?
Thank you. And there was another question, gentlemen, the back here.
Hi, Harsh from Westminster. There seems to me in OOO that there are two camps. One camp that sort of goes towards that everything is material, everything is materialist. And the other that says, well, if everything is material, then nothing is material. And I was wondering maybe if this is what you're referring to when you talk about complexity, that we have hit a point in the discussion. And maybe this is where my question pops up, in the sense, as a researcher, perhaps OOO is about moving away from what we've been talking about all this while in philosophy. And maybe it's giving us a way of untangling complexity and untangling the power structures of objects with objects of the world around us, the room we're inside, energy, London, government, etc. And maybe, therefore, you get to pick and choose. Maybe that's why you get to draw what you like and use it as an agency to explain a story that you see with objects, and not, therefore, you know, the rules foretold.
I think we'll take one more as well.
Just two little points I wanted to make. What about transitional objects in psychology? And also, what about how an object like a hammer in art, Duchamp's urinal, for instance, is a famous example, that an object can become completely, you know, divorced from its functional or even juxtapositional position.
Okay, so lots of things there. So last two points about objects divorced, when you take them out of context, they become divorced from their functionality. Point about transitional objects in psychology. And then the earlier questions, 100 is about as a way of entangling complexity. And then finally, about you're talking about Heidegger and about needing to put objects in context to think them in terms of relations and processes. Which of those does anyone want to pick up on?
Not specific to the questions, but it's to the general kind of the way...
Sure.
It's great. I mean, I could see that I feel a problem with this particular, if you like, philosophical turn towards the consideration of other things that we've neglected, the ecological, the natural, the world out there. And it goes back partly to the ethics, but it'll come into the skin of the hammer. Because... as I was trying to say, I come from a tradition which always tried to avoid this kind of dualism. And one of the reasons for that is my sense that most of the things we're actually dealing with are not actually of the natural world or simply given there as an outside. They are artifacts. In other words, there is a more complex relationship and cyclical relationship between us and the stuff around us. So actually, we're not worried about climate, we're worried about climate change. That is what made it artifactual. It's something that humanity did, and that brings a different ethical complexion, as it should, to our responsibility that we therefore feel. And that goes, I think, for all the big stuff, but also, in a sense, the little stuff. So when we say a hammer, I can't think of an abstract action. I think of, say, the kind of hammer that I'm used to with its particular shape, which I recognise as being used in some places, as it were, rather than... I think of the history behind it. I think of all the kind of stories, songs. It's very much an artifactual form that is in things I think you're implying in several of the questions. And actually it goes in a sense almost with the transitional object. That coming to understand that things have are not, you know, separate entirely from us. We have to understand where we are in relation to them. But at the same time, we often fail to acknowledge this, if you like, human beginnings of the object and this cyclical relation. And I think the problem with this philosophical turn is, despite the fact that it seems to want to incorporate things, actually, as you, I think, were implying very much in relation to things like language, once it starts becoming this, you know, the point of view of the thing, as though that has no artifactual quality at all, it actually simply exacerbates the original dualism that I thought we were trying to actually overcome in a more sophisticated understanding of what artifacts mean to us in the world.
Yeah, and just to add on to that, just I think it's Thomas, isn't it? I think I also have uneasiness with this kind of repetition of this Cartesian model giving the objects agency, which is just the same thing over and over. And I've often had that thought. And I've been thinking about the difference between animation versus movement. It's a really subtle difference, but it splits that. It kind of gets rid of that conundrum that you mentioned, which is it's no longer a metaphysical to say something is moving in relation to something else. It's not investing it with the same sort of subjective human life, which the term animation is. I don't know how that. That doesn't necessarily disagree with what you were saying, Esther. But there is something that we kind of assume that animation means movement, but it doesn't. It means life in this way. So I just wonder if maybe that might help a little bit. Just thinking about, just to go back to the question about the Duchamp's urinal, I think. That's interesting because that was Duchamp's attempt to take something from being a functional object to isolating it out of its functional operational context to make it a subject. So maybe, you know, that was a kind of comment on what happens when something is put into the form of the subject as opposed to the object. I don't know, does that sort of respond to what you're saying? So I think that was Duchamp's Duchamp's comment, maybe not consciously, but he was thinking about subject objects and the difference and how context and taking something out of its operational context and isolating it into white space makes it into a subject and how that's different, you know, than an object.
Esther?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting on animation because I very consciously like to move between that sense that animation is life that is self-generated. It's often how, you know, nature is perceived as animated in sort of romantic philosophies and so on, and then animation as a kind of technical practice in which, for the most part, it's the animator donating an illusion of life through movement and technical capacity. So there's this weird way in which it straddles. I think when you say, this notion of how do we take on the point of view of the object, and I suppose I think that is the impossibility and quite possibly the wrong quest, in a sense, which is why I suppose I maybe prefer to use the focus on the object in order to think about things such as the materiality of the object, its presence in the world as producing relationships to us. So I wrote this book about liquid crystals, tracing their history and their incorporation into televisions on the basis of a kind of slightly deranged assumption, but that it's to do with their liquid properties and crystalline capacities, that these things are harnessed. These are things that these chemical compounds do that both through their discovery speaks outwards, influences in a sense the way we can conceptualise history, and then narrowly produces the LCD screens that we are all permanently engaged with. So it's a sort of material capacity contained within the object that structures then are the world, the relationship between us and it, so hence the interest in the touch screen and how that produces gestures from us or makes our body and our knuckles and our movements legible entities. So I think for me it's less about the object having a point of view and more a sort of exertion of a materiality and capacities that then become part of our lives and our relationship to them.
One of the things that seems to have come up in several of the questions is the limitations of the terminology, that we seem to be stuck with this idea of subject and object, which seems to be restricting what we can say, or seems to be bringing us back to the idea of the passivity of the object, which is what we seem to be pushing against. Do we just need different words? Or do we just need to be more specific about the kind of objects? I think this is one of the things you've been saying, Daniel, that actually it seems to be quite a clumsy general term.
I mean, I think it's an interesting question in relation to the status actually of philosophy. And the reason I think that is that I think those people who are seriously engaged with those issues will, I think, quite rightly turn to philosophy, as I did, in order to understand there are ways you can think about this that do transcend subject and object. There are dialectical ideas, there are ideas within the tour, etc. And you can actually then get beyond that dualism. But we, or at least as an anthropologist, I'm constantly engaged in everyday work with everyday people. And colloquially, there is no doubt that so much of what we talk about and think about actually stems from that precise dualism. People think of themselves in relation to objects. They feel they know what they mean by that. And I have to, therefore, I think, always understand the different registers, that when I am talking with people, I want to respect that colloquialism. I don't want to tell them they're wrong because they're not philosophically astute and they don't really understand that this can be transcended at a philosophical level. At the same time, I also want to understand the consciousness that we can have and why that is important, that does provide that different perspective of from things. So I've always found that, in a sense, I'm sort of always slightly... I can read the philosophy, but then as soon as I'm going into field work and engage with people, I'm also trying to distance myself from it because I want to engage colloquially. And that is always going to be actually doist. That's how people understand themselves to be in the world. Things, people.
Although there's plenty of popular kind of animistic belief or belief that objects... You know, the objects do have agency, so this isn't just a philosophical discussion, or as the lady was saying about childhood sense of the world.
Yeah. Except that, historically, I would suggest, the vast majority of ways in which human beings have thought that in those terms is anthropomorphic, because it's religion. In all the world religions, we have, secular people might say, created objects that then have agency that we engage with. But it is both anthropomorphized and socialized. These are not thought of, generally speaking, as inert. Precisely, they are thought of as having the same kinds of intentionality, moral responsibility, or not moral responsibility, etc. And since world religions have been, in a sense, dominant in the way humanity has tried to, I think about this us and themness, I would tend to stress, if anything, the anthropomorphized I, or those qualities that people give to what they project as what otherwise might be seen as objects, rather than not.
Mm. I think the truth is we're all hybrids of subject and objects, and we're not just us. We're us with the phone. We're us with the computer. We're us with a chair. You know, I think that separation isn't really true anymore and ever. You know, we're all a hybrid of both subject and object. But people don't see that. People don't see that. It's, I guess it's a little bit scary for us to think that we're a hybrid and we're not purely subject or pure. And so even the object ontologists are thinking we're just objects and we're not. There isn't this hybridity between subject and object. But I don't know. I think on an everyday level, we are both. You know.
So, we take some more questions. Yeah, the two at the front.
Hi, thank you. Another Thomas, just a few things. Ever since Carolyn was speaking, I was struggling a little bit with that question of language being objects, of language being an object. I can definitely see Danny's perspective on the internet being an object and how he can approach that. But the question of language, I wrote down accidentally, language is not an object. This is completely Freudian slip there, but then it got me thinking about this. And obviously in the 70s there was, and 60s there was Levi Strauss with structuralism saying that we can read objects like language. And now this seems slightly paradoxical, almost tautological to me, that now you're saying, actually, language is an object, as opposed to objects are like language. So I think we are running a risk here of going around in circles, and I don't know where the way out is.
Thanks. There's one just behind us, one.
It seems to me, as an historian, that there's an issue of mastery here, especially in respect to the growth of robotics, the place of robots in daily life. There's a blurring of the boundaries, possibly, between subject and object, and a dichotomy that was there, perhaps, in conceptual terms, is no longer there. Does the panel have a view on that?
Thank you. We'll take one more question. Yep, my dear.
I've just been thinking along the lines of the value in an object and the object as having a sort of transitional value, and then again thinking of the object in terms of social media and the fact that social media is now classed as an object, as you would say. I was just wondering if you had come across any, Danny, if you'd come across any anything in your research about Facebook and bereavement and sort of what happens as a Facebook profile being an object, sort of an embodiment of a person, leaving a trace of a person, which is then, you know, I've seen it happen when a Facebook profile becomes a memorial or something like that. And again, that sort of transition as a result of the value of that person within that object.
Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to exaggerate how important Facebook has been in terms of transformation and moralization. Because prior to Facebook, we essentially tended to take religious models. There was a moment in which we had, you know, the burial, etc. And it wasn't altogether clear what kind of happened later. It was a relatively formal process. Facebook has become extremely common now as a bereavement site. And what it does is, I think it kind of leads us back to what most people would see as a more authentic kind of bereavement, because firstly, you can be more spontaneous. You might do something today. You might post something a month from now. And we like to think that we like now to be engaged not in this kind of very formal, ritualistic way with people, but we like to think of banter and jokes and informality and spontaneity as signs that the relationship is an authentic one. And so what you see is the way that Facebook has actually provided a space where this kind of more contemporary understanding of the authenticity of the person is actually much more reflected. And it was quite interesting that it just wasn't there. We didn't have a place where you could engage with the deceased with that sense of authenticity. So I think it's actually very interesting and very important. And the other bit, just to slide on to one of the other questions there, is, of course, when we're talking about language, we can think of it very abstractly, language, but actually, if we're talking about likes of Facebook, that means I'm dealing all the time with new genres of language that are certainly, you know, they take place in certain spatial positions, language of a meme as opposed to banter as opposed to etc. They're very contextualised. They, as it were, the meme is they combine with an image in a particular way. So I think it would be very difficult when you look at language contextualised in something like social media not to give it a similar kind of treatment as the image, the object, etc. Words, visual images, etc. now become a play in terms of the different capacities of communication that are developing with these new media. So at least in that context, I would say yes, objects.
I'm not sure exactly what you were asking about the robotics, but maybe with the robotics, it is a part of our life. And it's
we've got consciousness built into them now, supposed consciousness.
So maybe with the we should just approach robotics as a hybrid. We can't to keep them separate from us is kind of not, it's not going to work, is it? We have to accept them; they're part of our lives, for better or for worse. And perhaps a better approach is to they're hybrid human. They're human hybrid with object, and that might be a little bit less frustrating. I don't know. How can we get around up robotics now? It's not very pleasing, but and as for the language question, I think maybe it depends who you ask. Like you mentioned structuralism, so if you go a little further, if you go to Lacan is the object, isn't it? It's the for language is the primary object. So if you want, maybe I am coming from that perspective, is that to give language the primary object status, you know, it is an object and it's important to keep it as the primary object. Awesome. You might not agree.
I'll just say on the robots, I mean, I do think interesting things are emergent in around, you know, consciousness and that. I mean, even just the will to, through something like Google Deep Dream Project, to push on to see, you know, how does Google, you know, think, how does Google visualize the world peppered with eyes predominantly. I mean, these bizarre sort of things that it comes up with, but and also the sort of push into kind of bio, I suppose biopolitical systems in a sense, these, you know, smile detection technology, and then pushing that further so that constantly your machine can be reading your emotional response. And if at some level we imagine the sentimental, the emotional work, all of that is something that would define humanness or the subject and subjectivity, we are now very enthusiastically donating those powers to machines. And at the same time, I mean, we don't, you know, we can't underestimate how much they'll become the direct competitors for jobs or take the jobs such that people are seriously now discussing and implementing universal basic incomes and so on. So, I mean, these are massive shifts, and all of those have implications for how we think both about agency and about emotional legibility and who it matters to. You know, my computer will care much more that I'm sad when I'm looking at this episode of, you know, whatever program than anyone else in my family, you know, given probably how much more time I spend with my computer than I spend with my family. So, yeah.
Thanks. Should we take one more round of questions? Yep, there's one at the back. Should we take this one at the front and then go to the back?
Thank you all for what you've said so far. I was wondering on the language thing again. Would it make sense to introduce a distinction between a language and a discourse? I think French language makes an interesting starting point. It makes a distinction, unlike the English. That would be one. And also something you said at the beginning on the digital. What does the digital or the discourse around the digital brings into the discussions on objects? Thanks.
Thanks. And then we'll take the question at the back.
Actually, I was going to ask something quite similar, which was just about this idea of within language, subjects and objects, us and them. Professor Miller, you were talking about the colloquial us and them, and so using that as a sort of way of acknowledging the way things are used commonly. But I wonder if that's specific to English. And if we're thinking about language as an object, whether there's work on comparing how these relationships might take place in other languages.
Thank you. And there's another question here.
Hi. I was going to go back to the question that someone else posed earlier about ethics. And one of the things that it seems to me that we haven't considered so far, but actually spend most of my time thinking about, is when objects don't work and things when they stop and when they obstruct. And one very anthropocentric, I recognize, way of thinking perhaps about the ethics of allowing things agency is to think about when they stop working for us in ways that can be quite politically meaningful, you know, and to think about all the disastrous things that might happen if Google stops working because the machinery or whatever, I don't know very much about this, stops, or if, you know, or if the computers in an office stop working and that obstructs, you know, and it forces us to think about, you know, the things that we do every day as automata, or in other words, to think about objects that have agency to produce effects, as Jane Bennett talks about. Yes, and I was just wondering whether you, in your very different capacities, have given this much thought, whether that might be the agential ethical potential of objects.
Thank you. Don't know who wants to go first.
These are all really challenging questions. My hunch is that yes, that's where the ethics lies, is to think about when they don't work and to recognize that machines, you know, not working and failure is actually part of machine operation. It is, but we don't see that on an everyday level, and we get really frustrated when our phone doesn't go through or when our computer doesn't work. So, but that actually, everybody, we all have experienced that. So, I don't know exactly how to explain it, but I think you're right. I think that's where the ethics is there, is to recognize that machines fail as well as work and operate and function. So that failure is equally as much part of it. But that's all I can say, but I think that sounds interesting and somehow it does seem there's an ethical thing going on there.
Thank you again. I suppose what I tend to worry about is where you get fixated on sort of certain contemporary matters that we're familiar with. I suppose as an anthropologist, I tend to want to see these in a slightly broader, more comparative context. So if you take the use of language, for an anthropologist, you know, people had spells, right? People had ritual, people had prayer, in which a certain formulation around language would be efficacious in itself. Certainly the expectation is that it has agency, you can change the world. That existed before, it exists online. So, for example, we work in South India, where there is an idea in Hinduism that you should start the day in a very pure state as possible. So we find people will send out blessings very early in the morning, 6:30 in the morning, in the form actually of memes. They've appropriated the meme as a form of combination of language and image that is efficacious in that sense. It does something out there. But the reason for that is that social media has just provided a new way. I think the idea of the way language can be used comes, as in a sense, in that sense, always been there. And I think I'd say the same also in terms of failure. I did my PhD actually also in India. I worked mainly with farmers. And if you're a farmer, you're thinking about failure all day long because you are so dependent on climate. I mean, you spend all your time, you grow the crops, you wait and wait and wait, and the rain doesn't come or something else happens. So humanity, in a sense, has had this incredible consciousness of failure in the things around it. However, probably a lot more so, in a sense, when we were farmers than when we're dealing with the digital. So, I mean, I don't want to say nothing has changed. I mean, I'm constantly looking at the new capacities that the digital give us, the way we appropriate it because of the influences of these past kind of concerns, like spells, etc. But by and large, what we're talking about are much kind of larger principles about the way humanity engages with language and things that then find a new role or niche within this new kind of nexus, by and large.
In some ways, on the digital, I suppose I want to maybe reinforce the object nature of it, because there's that danger that it becomes truly seen as cloud-like and virtual and ephemeral, and yet it's the networks are based in these, you know, power-hungry, ugly farm factories, as they call them, data farm factories, and so on. So that sense of its materiality, I think, shouldn't be washed away. And also, I mean, I like the way Daniel's talking about the sort of artifactual as well, though, that this is something mixed with human imagination, human need, human projection, and so on. But I suppose if I've reinforced the object, the question about language suddenly made me think about the only other language I can speak, really, which is German, and thinking about Freud's notion of the subject as tripartitely composed, as we know, ego, id, and superego. And in German, it reinforces so much more clearly das Ich, the I, es, it, and unbewusste. I've gone differently, haven't I? Ego, superego, id. Anyway, the Ich and the es, you know, so the subject is an I and an it at the same time. So we already contain within ourselves, we are objects to ourselves, and we are not masters in our own home, and all of that kind of stuff, I think, is also important, because there's a danger just solidifying these positions for the sake of the argument, isn't there?
I think we've got time maybe for one more question. Yep, this one here. Oh, yep, that one, and then this one.
My question was on the use of memes as a policing force. I am involved in policing research, so I was curious if you could expand on that a bit more. Exactly what does that look like or entail?
Thank you. And here?
So I'm really interested in what you're saying about value. I think a lot of us have quite a deep understanding of, like, having meaningful relationships with physical objects. In what ways are our relationships with our digital possessions different or similar?
Very briefly, what we've noticed is that essentially there's two main kinds of meme. We're familiar here usually with the funny meme, the one about, you know, the politician or gender politics, or and that kind of jokey memes, even if it's on a serious topic. And actually, in a lot of countries we work, there's quite a lot of serious memes, Pentecostal memes, for example, and actually, generally, expressing, the point is, both of them express values. They're either, in a sense, putting down the values you tend not to agree with, like the way men behave, or they are asserting values you do believe in, like, you know, being born again. And having examined kind of that and seeing the way they're shared, what we find is that in many countries, people who are relatively shy, not necessarily even that literate, wouldn't write a big screed about values online, but they do share memes very, very readily. So memes have become a way in which people are not necessarily very confident, but feel very strongly about values, actually make it clear what they kind of do support and what they don't support. And that's important, because one of the key things, I think, in understanding the digital world is that how is it when we have such rapidity of change? You know, WhatsApp runs so big so quickly. People seem to know quite early on what is the appropriate and not the appropriate way to behave in that domain. How can that possibly be? In a few months, people seem to have that sense of value. And our argument is that the meme is actually a very important internal way within the online that people very quickly spread a whole series of ideas of value that give people an awareness of what the larger population actually feel is appropriate and inappropriate, and not necessarily the people who would be confident to actually write a lot or be explicit about value. So that's what we meant about the moral meme. And I think hopefully to some degree also shows how much the digital is actually used very much as a carrier of values, but not necessarily the sort of high political values, you know, the comments on sort of the, you know, Trump, etc., but actually often the common or garden values, precisely for things like, you know, gender relations, or how people should behave to each other in the public domain, or things like religion, etc.
Esther, Caroline?
I just also keep wondering about those rather absurd. I mean, wasn't the first sort of meme this cat with the "I has cheeseburger" thing, the particular font, which is a kind of surreal gesture or a disruption of any kind of cat meaning?
Actually, it's amazing how much cats and the difference between cats and dogs get moralised. Cats are constantly getting away with stuff, mm-hmm. and dogs are not. Mm-hmm. And if you actually study systematically, I mean, you might think it's just cute kitten, but there is so much more going on with the cats and dogs online. When you start to look at, particularly in different societies, at the way those two animals have a presence online, mm-hmm. it's a big thing going on there between cats and dogs. I promise you.
Yeah, and just with the digital, I mean, I suppose, you know, I have no answer here in relation to digital value, just the observation of this rapidity with which we've become, you know, all of us so visually literate and visually productive, but and have, in a sense, alienated our memories, these massive image banks, and I'm just intrigued to see how, you know, how we deal with that, and how the people who come after us deal with that amount of digital trace and digital information. I mean, it goes back to these sort of questions of sentiment, and, you know, can you bring yourself to delete a text from a loved dead person? You know, all of that weird sort of, you know, stuff that we're just learning.
I can't really talk about memes because it's not really an area of my interest, but I, my research, it is interesting. But I would say about value that we are in a new, it is a sort of shift in value and how we give, we're in a sort of reputation economy now, is even more than ever, which is because of online, because of what we like, what who we are, and who we, if we say we like something, if someone else says, and so it's a different, it's a kind of more dispersed and more discursive set of values, you know, that even more sort of magnified because of the internet. So I think the value has even more to do with reputation, and it's a different sort of economy, a shared economy, even more so.
Thanks. Okay, we have run out of time, so thank you all for coming, and join me in thanking our speakers.